The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Alternatives. I'm Aditya Chakraborty. On this episode, we're going to tackle one of the most fiercely contested issues in British politics. Nationalisation. Or should I say re-nationalisation? Because as most of you will know, we've ended up privatising most of our basic utilities, everything from trains to electricity. Nowadays, the Labour leadership under Jeremy Corbyn says it's going to bring much of that back into public ownership. And the result has been a howl of protests from the right-wing press, from the trade lobby groups, and from the Conservative Party. But weirdly, public ownership isn't that charged an issue in the rest of the world. From Houston to Jakarta, there's lots of instances of cities taking back into control basic utilities. And perhaps one of the most interesting examples of all of this is Germany, where they've really led the way in taking energy back into public ownership. Now, Germany, as you probably know, has got a history of radical green politics and is also fiercely anti-nuclear.
Renewable energies in Germany are a quite success story. We save
about... Not long after the Fukushima disaster, Chancellor Angela Merkel announced that Germany would close all of its nuclear reactors. It was a brave decision, responding to widespread community concern about the safety of their own reactors.
Merkel says the decision means huge opportunities for future generations.
Wir werden schrittweise bis Ende 2022.
For this instalment of The Alternatives, I went to Wolfhagen, which is a small town right in the middle of Germany. Now, Wolfhagen's the kind of place you wouldn't normally stop. It's lovely looking, but it's quiet and it's a bit sleepy and it's very small. But in 2006, it did something that was almost unprecedented. It took back into public ownership its electricity grid, and it booted out a multinational called E.ON from running its energy supply. And then it adopted a target of going 100% renewable by 2015. And the great drive towards green energy began in the middle of town, at a tiny cinema, with this film.
If you look at the 10 hottest years ever measured, they've all occurred in the last 14 years. And the hottest of all was 2005. Scientific consensus is that we are causing global warming.
I am Al Gore. I used Al to be Gore's An Inconvenient Truth, a film about climate change that was watched all around the world in 2006, but which, when it came to Wolfhagen, sparked a series of debates about what that small town could do to preserve the environment. One of the people who got fired up was Iris Degenhardt Meister. Guten Abend.
Guten Tag. Hello, Adita.
Now, Iris is vital to this story because she led the charge for Wolfhagen to have a wind farm, giant wind turbines looming over the town from its nearby mountain. The funny thing is, she's not even that green.
I wasn't. I really wasn't before. I was part of a kind of village council, you know? And one of the decisions we were heard about was that the wind park should be built really near to our village. So I, as a member of this village council, had to decide whether I was in favor or not. And this was the starting point for me to be involved in this process.
So, but Iris, I've been to your house and your garden is directly overlooked by the wind turbines, isn't it?
It is. We are really 1,000 meters away. Two of the four wind turbines we have always inside. Day and night, at night with the
signal. So you see them at all times,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And when you're having a barbecue in the summer, you can hear them going, can't you?
Yes, it depends on the wind direction, but often we can hear them.
So you're telling me that you weren't a particular environmentalist and that actually your own property would be in the shadow of these wind turbines. So what made you then think that having a wind farm would be a good idea?
Everybody was waiting and suffering from climate change. Things you read in the newspaper and said, I can do nothing. I have to wait till all the other politicians rule and take a common decision for everybody. But there was one who said, it is technically possible. We can manage it here in our small area and we'll prove it. And this was a point that convinced me. I felt, also responsible for the endanger we do to environment somewhere else where the coal is exploited or where accidents and nuclear power stations happen and other people suffer from energy production.
You made the jump because you felt personally responsible that you had to help fight climate change. Is that right?
Yes, indeed. I thought I can't always say, oh, the renewables are fantastic, and when they should be built nearby and they consider my own landscape and my view out of the window, then I say, oh, no, not here. Build them somewhere else like other NIMBYs do.
What's the German word for NIMBY?
We use your word, not in my backyard. We have adopted, you know. But only in our scene, I think, in this energy scene, the NIMBY, not everybody uses this word. But it's a shortcut. We call it other. We have another expression. We call it St. Florian's Prinzip.
I can see why you use the term NIMBY instead.
Yeah, that's more. It's abbreviation.
Okay, see, that's your choice, but there were a lot of people in Wolfhagen who didn't want the wind farm, right?
Yes, but it wasn't only the neighborhood of the wind park then, it was also the fear that that animals could be in danger or killed.
Your opponents used all kinds of tactics to try and stop the wind farm. Can you tell me some of those tactics?
Oh, yes, they wrote letters to the newspaper. They had kind of demonstrations. They made up a poster. It was in big letters, Hände weg, hands off the Rüderser Berg. Rüderser Berg means the area the forest is called, Rüderser Berg, or no wind turbines in our forests was the second slogan then. The atmosphere was quite heated, I would say, heated or aggressive. Sometimes it depends.
Aggressive?
Sometimes aggressive, but just verbal, you know, verbally aggressive. Nobody was struck or touched or thing like that. Just emotionally touched, of course, we all were.
But you're talking about a small town in which neighbours are now arguing with each other about what should happen with this wind farm, which in turn could actually hurt their own property values. I'm right, aren't I?
Some of them, they were afraid that the value of their ground would go down, you know, that their ground would lose value if they would sell it. We talked to each other as neighbors, but it was difficult anyway when we had traditional celebrations during the year. You, of course, avoid this topic. You talk about anything else but the wind park plants, you know?
Okay, so bring us up to date. How are things working now?
Those who had not really a special opinion, they accepted the wind park as natural. Not really natural, but as usual now. And, you know, and that all the things we, as who were in favor of this energy policy, what we imagined and calculated would happen, that this, in another sense, this came true. So it's good that nothing badly happened, you know, nothing bad happened of all those forecasts.
If you were to visit a small British town, would you advise them to try and do the same thing with their energy?
Yes, I could. And we have now experienced that it worked until now, with all the things we calculated and imagined, you have the income from the rent, and because the forest ground here is owned by the town, so they get a yearly additional income by having the ground where the wind turbines are installed on.
Iris is now a director at the City Cooperative, which has got a quarter stake in the energy company and which helped finance the wind farms and solar panels, so that Wolfhagen not only met its target of going 100% renewable, but actually beat it. Over the course of a year, 100% of all the energy Wolfhagen uses comes from renewable sources. There must be loads of people like Iris in Britain, people who are kind of a bit bothered about climate change and wonder what they could do about it. The question is, what could they do about it in Britain? Well, one of the big points of difference between Germany and the UK is that Germany's a lot more local in its economy. Local banks, local businesses, local energy grids. Britain, on the other hand, still revolves around Westminster and London. Here's Andrew Cumbers. He's a professor at Glasgow University, and he knows all about different models of ownership. So much so that Labour leadership, Jeremy Corbyn and John McDonnell, often turn to him as the man to go to on this stuff. The first question I put to him was, how can Germany be doing this? Fiscally uptight, overcautious Germany.
Although it has a fiscally conservative kind of culture at a national level, it is a much more decentralised country in terms of its banking and financial system. So, for example, because it's a federal system, each state within Germany, the land, has its own, effectively its own sort of central bank, clearing bank, which can have its own a bit more autonomy and powers for things like financing investment. So to give you a good example, Volkswagen is in the state of Hessen, and the Landesbank, which is kind of like the kind of clearing central bank, it's slightly different, but it's kind of like the autonomous central bank for Hessen, has spent hundreds of millions of euros on modernizing the infrastructure and energy system in Frankfurt, for example, in Frankfurt City, to provide a much more integrated energy system and grid system that means it can mix traditional sources of energy with renewables. So that kind of local financial capacity is available at the state level. And then the other thing you have, I think, that is very different to the UK, is you have lots of local, regional, cooperative and state banks, state-run banks as well, that also can provide a little bit of money and financing for local economic development projects. So I think that's quite key to understand about Germany, how it works. It's a much more decentralized political system, but alongside that, there's a sort of decentralized financial system.
Well, look, let's go back over that ground, because listen to you talk about the way in which Germany is so much more decentralized than the British state, and that they have this culture of regional banks. They've got much more muscular local government than we're used to in Britain. I can't help but feel that actually none of this stuff could ever really happen in Britain unless it happened in Westminster. Am I wrong to be that pessimistic? Tell me, cheer me up a bit.
But actually, I think you do have interesting things going on locally and even regionally. If even within other parts of the UK, if you look at Scotland, the Scottish government is using the powers that it does have to set up its own bank, its own public bank now. It's also setting up its own energy company. It's committed to do that. They're government policy commitments now. So these things are beginning to happen. But of course, the Scottish government, although it has a lot more power than a local council, it's still quite constrained. It's constrained in its borrowing powers. So, although you clearly, in a centralised state like the UK, you'd be looking to London and Westminster to begin that process. If say, the Labour Party under Corbyn and McDonnell really is committed to a radical devolution process, and they are talking about, you know, regional public banks to kind of fund the kinds of things that we might be talking about here, it's not, you know, I'm not at all pessimistic about the potential for this to happen. And the other thing is, you know, the public has been massively in favour of public ownership of the basic utilities for quite a long time. But what you'll find increasingly is that a lot of the kind of mainstream opinion, perhaps mainstream elite policy opinion, is also beginning to change, because I think there's a growing sense that privatisation isn't working. It's not just working in terms of, you know, not producing the cheap prices for consumers. But clearly, one of its biggest failings, especially in energy, but probably in water as well, is it's not investing in the modernization of the infrastructure that we all need to have these services provided at a decent level, you know, 20, 30 years down the line. And I mean, I think the penny is dropping with a lot of, I think even people in the Financial Times, you know, who write op-ed pieces, the more, you know, pragmatic ones would realize that actually the state is coming back in, and it kind of has to come back in if you're going to deliver long-term infrastructure renewal. I mean, if you look at the nuclear energy, I mean, you said Britain, we're more in favor of nuclear energy. I'm not sure we are as a sort of public.
No, but our energy suppliers are much less bothered about taking energy from nuclear than they would be in Germany.
But even there, you've had to have massive underwriting by the state of that whole project to make it happen. You know, I think what we need to start saying to do is actually, you know, the state is picking up the tab, or if not the state, the public is picking up the tab for a lot of these privatized services anyway. And actually there are some really good credible arguments that you can do this much cheaper in the public sector. And that's another thing that's driving a lot of the remunicipalization in Germany, both in perhaps more conservative rural areas, as well as the more metropolitan areas, is a realization that actually by local politicians, who probably are pragmatists rather than ideologues of any kind, that actually the things that they privatized in the 90s can deliver revenue that they can cross-subsidize other cash-strapped public services. And I think the other interesting thing about Germany, you know, they've had a similar austerity politics at the national level, but that means that there's a lot more pressure on local governments, on their budgets. And where local governments have actually still got the power to take things back into public control when a privatized franchise comes up for renewal, they've done it because they realize, well, actually, rather than revenues feeding shareholder dividends to these private companies, we can bring all that back in-house and begin to cross-subsidize, you know, cash-strapped public services.
All right, so look, Andrew, we've talked a bit about the ways in which Germany's politics are structurally different from Britain's. And we've also, you've tried to cheer me up by telling me how Britain is moving towards a different kind of political economy and is more open to different ways of organising its energy sector, for instance. But do this final thing for me. If Germany's form of public ownership is driven at local level, financed at local level, often carried out by, as you say, pragmatic local politicians, what do you think in Britain a programme of public ownership might end up looking like?
Personally, I don't think that. I mean, there's a lot of discussion about, well, we could have lots of more cooperatives, and I think that's true. We could have very, very diverse hybrid forms of public ownership, but I think where it's important, critical public utilities, for me anyway, say the water sector, you would want those coming back into local public control. So I Thames Water, why couldn't that be something that's publicly owned by whatever, whether it's the Greater London or whether it was a combination of city or local boroughs or authorities. I would think you would want regional public forms of public ownership in the water sector. The energy sector is a bit different because you've got a slightly more complex way of running things. But I would think you'd want to nationalise the grid, because that does need national strategic capacity to modernise the grid, and the modernisation of the grid that's required is to shift away from a very centralised grid structure that's based around big coal and gas-fired power stations and nuclear stations to a much more decentered grid that would allow lots of local renewable projects to kind of link up and supply to. So the energy system, you'd probably want a kind of multi-scalar, if that's a kind of geographical term, you want a multi-scalar form of public ownership where you have national ownership at the kind of infrastructure level. But there's no reason why you couldn't have a lot more regional and local public ownership at the sort of, you know, municipal level, like you do have in places like Wolfhagen. So actually we could decentralise quite well.
Andrew, taking public utilities back into public ownership sounds nice, but it's a big headache. It involves costs, it involves transfer, it involves often big battles with multinationals. Why on earth would Wolfhagen or any town or city want to do that?
Because ultimately it's much cheaper to run things in the public sector. There's a great piece of work by David Hall and his colleagues at the University of Greenwich that suggested that if we took the energy sector back into public ownership, we would save £3 billion a year that we wouldn't pay on shareholders' dividends alone. So I think if you leave aside all the political arguments, the environmental arguments, it's far more cost-effective to run things internally within the public sector.
And because it's satisfying. This weekend, Iris went out to visit her beloved wind turbines just for you, the listener. She sent you this dispatch.
I'm standing next to turbine 2 in the forest and I'm feeling really proud when I look at them up into the sky. See them moving in the blue sky. I see winter, the red signed wings moving elegantly round and around and producing clean, renewable energy that our town needs and our world needs to reduce climate change.
That's Iris. She just loves windy days. I'm Adit Chakraborty. Do get in touch with me. I'm at alternatives@theguardian.com. This episode of The Alternatives was produced by Lily Ames and Phil Maynard.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.